its way from the estate to the street. It was fast becoming the favorite sport of the working class. Kids started playing it on pavement. Football clubs popped up. Immigrants and non-immigrants found themselves on the same street, or cancha, together. Their love for the beautiful game united them. Soccer introduced a national identity that was represented by the working class, writes David Goldblatt in The Ball is Round, an epic 900-page history of the sport. Quote, the Argentine football player and the Argentine football style became central icons of new notions of masculinity and the nation. The celebrated gaucho gave way to the celebrated pibe, the streetwise kid from the barrio, the one who gets by on sheer cunning and will. The pibe wasn't roping cattle from horseback, he was hooking a football. This was the new Argentine dream, the rags-to-riches football god. The quintessential pibe is legendary futbolista Diego Maradona. As a child, Maradona once fell into a cesspool. He would later recall that the memory of his disgust was one of the things that drove him to succeed. Like Robert Diggs, Maradona found himself awash in literal shit. And like Robert Diggs, Maradona had the courage to say, nunca más. Jewish gauchos were comparatively few, but what about Jewish pibes? Around the turn of the century, the roughly 120,000 Europeans of Jewish descent living in Buenos Aires were generally considered outsiders. They dressed and spoke and worshipped differently from other immigrant communities. They lived primarily in their own barrios, and they were seldom thought of as Argentinian. But as soccer's popularity grew, Jewish children started playing it, among each other and with others from their outgroup. And they didn't stop playing it as they grew up. By the 1920s, football had become pastime numero uno for Jewish Argentines. The cancha was common ground. Now there was something safe for everyone to make small talk about. Local newspapers were already portraying football as the new symbol of porteñidad, porteñoness. Thus, the Jewish footballer became porteño. Tel Aviv University professor Ronan Rein explains that belonging to a football club was a way for Jewish people to become Argentinian. Football, Dr. Rein writes, was a means of creating a new social identity. Jewish Argentines didn't abandon their faith, of course, but in adopting Argentina's unofficial religion and in joining with others to worship the almighty goal, Jewish Argentines made differences of faith and custom seem less scary. Public perception of Jewishness gradually became less hysterical. Jewish Argentines were part of the in-group. Barnard College historian Jose Moya writes that Jewish residential segregation in Buenos Aires dropped faster and sharper than in most cities. Within a few years, Jewish Argentines no longer needed to live shoulder to shoulder in order to feel safe. They soon dispersed into virtually every neighborhood in the city. Were the porteños really so exceptional? After all, Buenos Aires was hardly the only city in the Western Hemisphere to embrace football. The sport swept Latin America. Sao Paulo, Santiago, Mexico City. New World boomtowns with huge immigrant populations. While football helped depressurize tension between cultural groups in those cities as well, historians agree that the effect was more pronounced in Buenos Aires. Porteños simply became less fearful more quickly. So why the difference? Granted, the factors that drive social change are varied and complex, but in Buenos Aires, one factor is beyond dispute. Participation in football was higher there than in any other city. Buenos Aires boasts the highest concentration of football clubs and more people play per capita than anywhere in the world. Societies where play, both with rules and without, is used in social practices, explain Antonacci, Norcia, and Palagi, show a more fluid, democratic structure and are more open to new incomers. Play helps knock down social hierarchies by releasing the tension that prevents people from speaking up or out of turn. Even when play takes the form of win or lose competition, as long as the exercise is about the game and doesn't devolve into an exercise in destroying the other people, it has this camaraderie building effect. And Buenos Aires has more of this effect than any comparable city in the world. Play led to something of a virtuous cycle in Argentina. More football playing meant less segregation, which meant even more football playing and even less prejudice. As Professor Miles Houston of Oxford University found in a series of studies, city neighborhoods, quote, with the most mixing between ethnic groups, led to the highest reductions in racial prejudice. And neighborhoods in the early to mid-20th century had less ethnic and racial segregation in Buenos Aires than any of its Brazilian, Chilean, or Mexican counterparts because of soccer. They were comfortable living together because they played together. Of course, play is no panacea for prejudice. I'm acutely aware of and disgusted by the racism, homophobia, and general hooliganism that stubbornly persist among some football and soccer fans, both in Latin America and worldwide. Fans have argued, for example, that homophobic cheers are merely a football tradition with no meaning outside the game. But this is a coward's explanation. I cordially defy anyone who claims that the magic circle of play sanitizes bigotry. So let's not let a few bad apples get away with abusing the magic of play this way. Love is love and hate is hate, on or off the field. And xenophobia persists in Argentina as it does everywhere, football notwithstanding. But in spite of this, modern Argentina still ranks high among nations in terms of tolerance and inclusivity. In Argentina's Jewish population, over 200,000 by most estimates. At the time of this writing, there were about as many Jewish people in Argentina as in Haifa. In 2014, Pope Francis I staged a battle between representatives of the world's biggest religions, Jews and Christians, Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists. The old pontiff pitted them one against another. Why? For charity. You see, Francis is Argentinian. He loved football and was hell-bent on watching adherents of the world's major religions go toe-to-toe on the field, with proceeds going to a good cause. The Pope had grown up knowing that play helps us get along. Quote, "Tonight's match will reflect on the universal values which football and sport in general can promote. Loyalty, sharing, welcoming, dialogue, trust in the other," the Pope said. "It's about values which joins every person, regardless of race, culture, and religious belief." It's not just sports that have this in-grouping effect on our brains. Play outside of sport can get the same psychological results. Antonacci and her colleagues teach that even unstructured play limits xenophobic aggression. And speaking of aggression, remember Wu-Tang? Those 9 street-hardened lyrical warriors did not see themselves as an in-group at first. Robert Diggs knew their energy had the power to create or to destroy when he first hosted his in-house rap battle. And if we think about it, RZA's intramural competitions were actually a kind of game. That game helped enemies like Raekwon and Ghostface to bond. The circle worked its magic. Against the odds, Wu-Tang became a clan. Now think about that fear-busting improv comedy, the secret sauce that helped the geeks at Art of Charm find their groove. By engaging in awkward play, shy guys started to see strangers for the first time as potential members of their own in-group rather than as opponents or terrifying outsiders. Dr. Nardi's World of Warcraft guild thought they were battling a luminous blue-green water monster. In fact, they were bridging social and geographical divides to an extent rarely seen in, say, a fractious UN General Assembly. No one had to sign a treaty. The guild's bridge building was simply the natural result of playing with different people. When Argentines started playing football together, they became more comfortable with differences that had frightened them before. And as Argentina's national team got good, with players like Diego Maradona becoming world famous, play became something that enabled practically any two people in Argentina to have a conversation, no matter how different they appeared on the outside. You'll recall how our friend Keith Yamashita likes to say that micro-actions add up. Each of our stories of play reinforce this point. Valone stabilized an unstable group through 1,000 micro-opportunities. She set up an environment where her people could accumulate lots of little bonding moments in the magic circle together. And they became a great team through it. The sum of hundreds of positive, fun, social interactions helped the Art of Charm geeks get better at being social. And they were reported not just getting better at dating, but better at work, at networking, at collaboration in general. And after thousands and thousands of encounters on the football concha, the residents of Buenos Aires found a shared identity through play as well. In all these cases, people who on paper should not have gotten along could now progress together in the zone. Overcoming fears and stabilizing group relationships is not the end, of course, to the challenge of making a great team tick. In fact, sometimes our teams sit outside of the zone, not because we have too much fear of conflict or too many problems with each other, but because things are going so well. Or so we think. Chapter 4. Angelic Troublemakers. Part 1. On a September evening in 1887 in New York City, a 5'5" brunette named Nellie mysteriously showed up at the front door of 84 Second Avenue, her pupils the size of saucers. Her clothes were stylish but old. A gray flannel frock, brown silk gloves, a straw sailor's hat, and a gray veil. She had a low voice, a strange accent, and a distant look on her face. She carried no identification or personal effects. The four-story brick building whose bell she rang was matron Irene Stannard's temporary home for females. For 30 cents, a working-class woman could stay the night in safety. An attendant set Nellie up with a shared room and a meal. But by the end of dinner, something was clearly off. The girl, 19 years old and 112 pounds, seemed frightened. A wild, hunted look in her eyes, according to the other women there that night. Nellie's story was strange. Upon questioning, she said she was from the American South and her last name was Brown. But she would later say that she was from Cuba and her surname was Moreno. She had lost her trunks. She worried about all the murderers out there in the world and all the people outside with so much work to do. She stared unblinking and whispered to herself over and over. Around the time Nellie started asking if the other ladies in the house were insane, they decided she was dangerous. "I'm afraid to stay with such a crazy being in the house," said one. Another declared, "She will murder us before morning." Nellie didn't close her eyes all night. She stared at the bugs in the windowsill while the ladies phoned the police. Two court appearances and three doctor's visits later, Nellie was lying on a bed at Bellevue Hospital, waiting to transfer to a mental asylum. As she lay awake that night, Nellie heard the nurses talk about her and the other women. In the morning, a doctor asked her if she ever heard voices. "Yes, there's so much talking, I cannot sleep," she replied truthfully. "I thought so." They declared Nellie positively demented. She soon found herself walking a plank to the ferry that would take her to her new home. "What is this place?" Nellie asked the man who escorted her off the boat. "Blackwell's Island, an insane place where you'll never get out of." Part 2. Pablo Picasso was 6 years old when Nellie was committed to the insane asylum. It was only a few years later that his own mental health problems would begin. He became severely depressed at 20. His paintings for the next few years reflected this melancholy. They were washed out with blue. Picasso managed his depression enough to become Spain's most famous painter, and soon the world's. But by the time he was 60, his melancholy had worsened. This led to a rather peculiar morning routine. As Picasso's lover at the time, Françoise Gillot, who was 40 years his junior, wrote in her memoir, "He always woke up submerged in pessimism. He'd lie in bed, groaning. And then, without fail, the following series of events would unfold. His chambermaid would bring him his coffee and toast. Picasso would lie there complaining, 'Why get up? Why paint?' He was miserable. He was sick. Life was unbearable. He would stay under the covers for at least an hour, while Gillot pleaded with him to get up and paint. 'You're not so sick as that,' she would say. Your friends love you. Your painting is marvelous. Everyone thinks so. Picasso would eventually reply, "Well, maybe you're right. But are you sure?" She would insist that she was. Finally, after a little more moaning, Picasso would drag himself out of bed and proceed to paint until dark. And the next morning, the routine would start again. Picasso painted more during the 10 years he lived with Gillot than he did each decade before and after. During this period, he painted his famous Les Femmes d'Alger series, the last painting of which set a world record at auction in 2015, selling for $179 million. We'd be justified in theorizing that this wouldn't have happened if Gillot had not coaxed Picasso out of bed. This little story teaches us something more than how to get a depressed painter to pick up his brush. Often, we have all the ingredients we need to do amazing work, but we are metaphorically stuck in bed. This is what happens when we don't have any cognitive friction on our teams. We may have all sorts of differences available for the harnessing, but we're not making use of them. When it comes to team dynamics, depression isn't usually the culprit that puts us in the inertia zone. More often than not, the problem is, ironically, prior success. The more successful we are at using a set of perspectives and heuristics, the more inflexible our brains become on that particular topic. Psychologists call this cognitive entrenchment. People get cognitive entrenchment the longer they work on the same things in the same ways, and especially when those ways work. Research shows us that the longer people work together, the more similar their work styles tend to become. We may start out different, but the more time we spend together, the more we start speaking, behaving, and even dressing similarly. After a while, our perspectives have a tendency to converge. We learn and mimic each other's heuristics. Over time, it is easy for us to get stuck in the same patterns of thinking. The business world often calls them best practices, but psychologists correctly call them groupthink. And groupthink, as we've learned, eliminates cognitive friction. We find good solutions on Problem Mountain and then settle down on them. Research by Eric Dane, professor at Rice University, sums up the resulting irony. Quote, "Because of cognitive entrenchment, experts may be restricted in their ability to identify optimal solutions to problems, to adapt to novel situations, and to generate radically creative ideas within their domain." In other words, often the things that keep us stuck on a mountain peak are our own expert perspectives and heuristics that got us there in the first place. Imagine our mountain range diagram again, this time with a group of people standing proudly on one of the not-so-high peaks, congratulating themselves. "This is definitely it, guys," says one. "Man, we're smart," says another. In these cases, like our Picasso story hints at, the thing that holds us back from our dream team potential is the lack of a teammate who can give us a certain kind of nudge. Part 3. On the first night inside Blackwell's Island, Nellie shivered uncontrollably. The facilities were freezing. Inmates stood in the hallways chattering from the New York cold. When Nellie asked for a nightgown, the nurse replied, "You don't need to expect any kindness here, for you won't get it." She was doused in freezing water, scrubbed roughly, and forced to clean the nurse's quarters. The asylum had opened up in 1839. Next door to the prison built there a few years earlier. It was the first city-run mental asylum, part of a push to provide living space and round-the-clock care for the mentally ill, and to keep them separate from the public. By the time Nellie got to Blackwell's, the number of committed patients around the country had shot up to 150,000. New York had several packed asylums at this point. Lunacy had become an excuse to lock away anybody that society didn't want around. Vagrants and paupers were routinely thrown into the asylum without having committed a crime. Worse, any woman deemed unruly or who voiced strong opinions could be sent to the asylum on the word of a husband or brother. They were locked up with the schizophrenics. Asylums like Blackwell's were notoriously underfunded and understaffed. But officials like New York City Mayor Abram Hewitt gave little priority to the matter, or even much thought. Hewitt was busy working on tax reform and planning the development of the subway system. So for 50 years, the mental asylum system had run itself. And that was how New Yorkers liked it, Places like Blackwell's Island kept unwanted neighbors, as the saying goes, out of sight and out of mind. But in its decades-long inertia, the asylum system and its patients were going nowhere. Society had found a mountain peak and set up camp on it for good. Low standards were not improving. Patients like Nellie found themselves in prison-like conditions that offered little chance of help or pain relief, where the world no longer had to think about them. Nellie had appeared disoriented and confused that night at Matron Stenard's, but she had not done anything particularly dangerous. Regardless, her strangeness and paranoia sent threat signals to the collective amygdala of the ladies at the shelter. Her unusual way of speaking and thinking bothered the police, who subsequently dealt with her. So they locked her away. Something was indeed off about Nellie, but it wasn't what the Blackwell staff thought. Part 4. The G-Corp executives were flabbergasted. For confidentiality purposes, I've changed the actual name of this company. They congregated in a spacious, exposed brick loft in central London, eyes wide. The setting was the office of Sense Worldwide, a consulting firm tasked with helping expand the market for one of G-Corp's struggling products. The product was the blister cushion, a bandage that released ointment into a wound over time. Several years after blister cushion's invention in the 1980s, sales had plateaued. G-Corp, a giant health goods company with products found in every major pharmacy in the world, couldn't figure out how to make its blister cushion line grow. The company sat in the inertia zone, like Picasso lounging in his bed. It wasn't like G-Corp hadn't tried to get out of bed, though. It had explored a few ideas here and there, but the company couldn't come up with anything better than the existing blister cushion product, or at least nothing that attracted more customers. Dr. Dane's research on cognitive entrenchment describes this scenario exactly. When we have a solution that has worked well for a long time, it becomes difficult to see any other way. Problem solvers can become fixated on a particular method to their own detriment, he says. That's why G-Corp had hired the Sense team, led by a man named Brian Miller, a British writer and game designer. He specialized in helping companies find radically better mountain peaks, so to speak. After assessing the situation, Miller told the G-Corp execs to come by his office to talk with a focus group about blisters. Little did they know, Miller had a surprise prepared. Instead of random, demographically diverse people recruited from the mall, the kind of typical focus group that people at G-Corp would be used to, a group of beautiful women filed into Sense's office. They sported long hair, makeup, and painted fingernails. And instead of shopping bags, they brought with them an array of spiky leather boots and heels. They were professional dominatrices. As the ladies took their seats, the executives shook their heads. This was not G-Corp's target customer. People who got paid to sexily whip other people were not who they had in mind when they told Miller they wanted to expand their customer base. All the dominatrices in the world could only buy a tiny fraction of the blister cushions G-Corp wanted to sell. What kind of gimmick was this? The history of focus groups dates back to World War II, when psychologists had people watch military propaganda films. The doctors would hide behind one-way glass to observe which messages were most persuasive to the average person. They wanted to know what kinds of language and imagery might best influence people. After the war, a different kind of propagandist took up this practice, marketers. Companies began recruiting people to test which products and campaigns were the most persuasive to the largest number of potential customers. These focus groups soon evolved into a way for companies to get inspiration for what to do in the first place. If you're out of ideas, why not ask everyday people what they want and then make it? Brian Miller's agency existed in part because these kinds of focus groups have a big problem. Everyday people tend to come up with everyday ideas. Most average consumers are actually pretty happy with the product they've got, Miller explained to me. I was very happy with my late 90s Nokia, he says. If you'd said, what new features could we add to your phone? I would have said, this phone is perfect. I can't help you with that. Our amygdala will often cause us to be uncomfortable with exactly the kinds of ideas that focus groups are supposed to come up with. Anything creative or different is going to feel foreign, even scary. Studies find this in business all the time. In fact, people who introduce creative ideas, according to research led by Jennifer Muller of the University of Pennsylvania, are less likely to be listened to or made leaders. That's because, quote, the expression of creative ideas is often associated with uncertainty. This explains the list of things that bombed in focus group research, according to Miller. PCs, Pop-Tarts, Seinfeld, nachos, and Aeron chairs. People didn't like them. Until they got used to them, messy cheese chips and neurotic New York sitcoms were uncomfortable concepts for many people. The Aeron chair is an excellent example, actually. For ages, business executives sat in big leather chairs. Aeron chairs, by contrast, were thin, low profile, and made out of mesh. So even though Aerons were more comfortable, flexible, and breathable, focus groups rejected them. A silly-looking chair with tiny holes in it was a threat to an executive's powerful appearance. It made her look like part of the out-group. Aeron's popularity, therefore, started with people on the fringes. The people who really liked them were very petite women, very obese people, and elderly people, Miller explains. Because you could get in and out of them very fast, because your skin breathes, and because they were so super adjustable. Little by little, average business people became exposed to Aeron through these not-so-average chair users. And little by little, the chair became less threatening. So, despite completely failing in focus groups, Aeron went on to become the best-selling office chair in the world. Instead of focus groups of average people, Aeron needed people with a more extreme perspective. It turned out that a very large or very small person could tell you more about the problems with office chairs than a very powerful person could. People who have those extreme needs are often the people who are the most articulate about things, Miller said. They're like someone who's staring up from the foot of a giant mountain on the problem mountain range. Their extreme perspectives help them see farther through the fog. Imagine that group of people stuck on the not-so-high mountain peak again. There's a really big mountain peak nearby that they can't see. At the foot of the giant peak is a person with a mohawk, representing the extreme perspective, and she's looking up the big mountain saying, "Do you see this?" This is why, Miller explained, if you're trying to make a better insect repellent, you won't get as much from a focus group full of vacationers as you will by talking to people who live in shanty towns. Somebody once said to me, "Some days I have to choose between buying insect repellent and buying food. For a day my kids can live off a little bit of rice, but I can't go a day without insect repellent, because if my kids get dengue, they might die," Miller recalled. That's somebody who will happily sit for 3 hours and tell you all of their issues with the current repellents on the market. They can tell you how to make a better one. That's somebody you want on your team. After introducing the G Corp executives to the dominatrices, Miller distributed Sharpie markers. He then made the executives kneel in front of the focus group members and draw circles around their blister spots. This was not comfortable, but that was part of Miller's point. G Corp had been in the inertia zone for so long that his team needed a push. They needed to experience an extreme perspective on blisters, Miller said. And who has more to say about the way a blister bandage looks and feels than someone who has to wear complicated, tortuous heels to work, and whose feet are inspected closely by their clients? The executives got the point. But that was not the end of the focus group. To their surprise, a crew of special forces soldiers tromped its way through the doors. That's because, Miller said, if you ask the question, who thinks 10 times as much about blisters than a healthcare executive, the answer would not be random shoppers from the mall. It would be something like a person who has to run 10 miles a day through the desert in combat boots. Miller's tactic, bringing in extreme people to focus groups instead of average ones, is a clever way to get cognitive diversity. If we return to Problem Mountain, imagine a special forces soldier has joined the person with the mohawk. The soldier is on the other side of the big mountain, looking up and saying, "It's crazy over here, too." These people had spent more time than anyone exploring the Blister Mountain range, and thus developed a unique perspective on it. They could see the biggest mountains that the blister makers couldn't. And to deal with those big mountains, they developed heuristics that could give G Corp's product designers a path forward. The soldiers articulated an entire spectrum of type and severity of blister that one could have, depending on how the blister formed and how many days old it was. The dominatrices explained how they would cut and alter blister bandages into shapes that worked with their shoes and fit around the curves of their feet and ankles and still looked good. G Corp developed a new line of blister pads of different shapes and thicknesses based on what the dominatrices showed them. They made pads for different blister ages and severities based on what the soldiers taught them. And it turned out that when you offered these type of blister pads to average people, they bought more of them. By tapping into the cognitive diversity of extreme consumers, G Corp managed to find better solutions for regular consumers. And they started making more sales again. There's an important thing we should note about this story. Miller could have interviewed dominatrices and soldiers and summarized their ideas in a report for G Corp, but he didn't. He made the executives get on their hands and knees and draw circles around people's blisters with Sharpies. A key part of his extreme focus group exercise is the theater of having his clients experience them firsthand. That's because sometimes being aware of the path up the mountain is not enough. Sometimes we need to be pushed into the zone, provoked to get off our peak, so we have no choice but to either retreat or make progress. G Corp was paying Miller in part because he was the team member they needed to nudge them out of their comfy chairs. Part 5. Blackwell's Island Insane Asylum wasn't just cold, Nellie quickly discovered. It was disgusting. The food was unpalatable. Hard black bread with insects, inedible butter, and rotting prunes. The tea tasted like copper. The nurses were crude and rough. Attendants mocked, slapped, and choked the inmates. They expectorated tobacco juice and berated the patients when they weren't gossiping about the doctors in front of them. Nellie was locked in a room at night with 6 women, one who raved and paced all night, and several others who seemed perfectly sane. Nellie tried to tell the doctors she wasn't crazy. But the more she tried, the more convinced they were that she was nuts. "What are you doctors here for?" she inquired. "To take care of the patients and test their sanity," an exasperated caretaker replied. "Very well," Nellie said. "There are 16 doctors on this island, and excepting 2, I have never seen them pay any attention to the patients. How can a doctor judge a woman's sanity by merely bidding her good morning and refusing to hear her pleas for release? Even the sick ones know it is useless to say anything, for the answer will be that it is their imagination." They told her to shut up. Part 6. Dr. Charlene Namath of UC Berkeley spent her career studying the science of human influence. Specifically, she's an expert on how people with minority viewpoints can influence others. Typically, when a team comes together to make a decision, the majority opinion wins out. But in the 1970s, Namath became interested in what kinds of influence people who disagreed with the majority had on group decision-making, such as juries deciding whether someone was guilty of a crime or not. She put together a bunch of experiments to find out. In one, she assembled groups of 6 people at a time to work on little puzzle-like challenges together. The object was to determine if there was a hidden figure inside whatever they were looking at. What she found was surprising. Groups of people who tended to agree that there was no hidden figure on a given challenge were sometimes correct and sometimes not. But groups that had 1 or 2 people who often disagreed with the majority opinion ended up getting more answers right. Having a naysayer in the group made the rest of the group think harder. This should remind us of what we saw with our cops of different genders. Having someone with a different perspective helps the rest of the group think more critically. The subtlety that Dr. Namath discovered is that the person who thinks differently doesn't always have to have the right answer for the group to get smarter. She or he just has to be a little difficult. Namath's experiments went on to show that the presence of a minority viewpoint, at least one person who vocally disagrees with the common perspective, tends to help groups look at issues on all sides. Meanwhile, groups that are very similar and have no dissenters tend to look for information, quote, that corroborated the majority view. In other words, when we are on the same page, we tend to see things that prove that we're right. When we're not on the same page, we become more likely to see parts of the picture we've missed. Dissenting views by a minority of individuals, Namath writes, stimulate the kinds of thought processes that, on balance, lead to better decisions, better problem solving, and more originality. Notice the word choice here. Dissenters stimulate the kinds of thought processes that lead to progress, They shake us, spur us. They do for inert groups what play does for chaotic groups. They move us into the zone. We might call this process provocation. Provocateurs are people who force us out of inertia, like Gillot did to get Picasso out of bed, or Miller did to get the G-Corp execs off their comfortable mountain peak with their blister cushions. Whether it comes from our in-group or out-group, provocation stretches the rubber band. In 2009, a group of researchers recruited a bunch of sorority and fraternity members from colleges for a study. Frats and sororities are notoriously good at cultivating conformity in their groups. It's kind of the point. So their members are perfect candidates for experiments involving in-group and out-group interactions. And in this case, what can help a tight-knit in-group break out of its groupthink? First, the students were given 20 minutes to study a murder mystery. Then they were placed in groups of three people from their own frat or sorority to decide together who the murderer was. After 20 minutes, each group was joined by a fourth person, either from within their same frat or sorority or from a different one. What the researchers found was that having an outsider join the group led to team members feeling less comfortable, more agitated, and less confident in their answers. And it also led them to double their chance of getting the right answer. The work felt harder when the groups were joined by an outsider, and that was precisely what helped those groups find better solutions. Provocateurs, in other words, push us off our mountain peak. Sometimes this just makes life difficult, but sometimes it helps us discover that there's a taller peak just ahead. Part 7. Before they sent her to the asylum, the doctors at Bellevue had labeled Nellie the most peculiar case that ever came into the hospital. And that may be because she was only pretending to be insane. Nellie was actually a 23-year-old woman named Elizabeth Jane Cochran. To the public, she was Nellie Bly, a reporter for the New York World, run by Joseph Pulitzer. For years, Blackwell's had a reputation for poor conditions. But nobody besides the nurses and inmates had been able to get a close look. Not even city officials knew what was really happening there. And no one was working hard to find a better way to take care of its patients. After 10 days at Blackwell's Island, Bly had gathered enough first-hand material for a tell-all report. Pulitzer rescued her from the asylum and published her 17-chapter exposé, which took over editions of the New York World. "The insane asylum on Blackwell's Island is a human rat trap," Bly summarized. "It is easy to get in, but once there, it is impossible to get out." Some 1,600 women occupied Blackwell's Island Asylum, and many of them were not crazy, she revealed. For example, one woman had been suffering from an illness that made her hair fall out. She was committed for not much more than her unusual appearance. Another woman, who spoke only German, was there because a doctor simply hadn't been able to communicate with her. Another woman had been locked up after having gotten sick at a breakfast. And hundreds had been locked up for just disagreeing with the men in their lives. The nurses were unqualified. One reported the temperature of an inmate to be 150 degrees. The doctors flirted inappropriately, and until Nellie Bly, hardly anybody gave Blackwell's or the mental health system a thought. The system was a success in the public's eyes. That's why Bly's series shook New York City Hall so hard. The severe condition of the asylum underscored the need for funding and reform at every stage of the mental health care system. Bly's story was an act of investigative journalism, a practice she helped pioneer, that proved to be the provocation the city needed to take a fresh look at things. It resulted in a grand jury hearing, after which New York City apportioned $1 million to fixing Blackwell's asylum. Not long after, the whole asylum system was replaced with a more humane and effective National Mental Hospital Program. The doctors at Blackwell's were ashamed and furious when Bly's report came out, but it was too late. The public and the government had been pushed out of bed. Whether they wanted to or not, they now saw mental health care from a new perspective. The only reasonable thing to do now was to search for a better mountain peak. If it had been up to Blackwell's, Bly would have been punished for sneaking into the asylum and exposing them. They would blame her instead of seeing what they needed to see from her. Fortunately, the government had established a process for allowing provocateurs like Bly to to help with civic progress in this way, through the U.S. Constitution's right to a free press. In America, the press is often referred to as the fourth branch of government. When the founders set up the executive, judicial, and legislative branches as the team that makes up the government, they created explicit protection for the press in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, because they knew that the press would be an essential teammate for a functioning democracy. Investigative journalism's goal, as the saying now goes, is provocation in a nutshell, to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. It shows us perspectives that we don't see so we can break out of inertia. Provocation like this can indeed be uncomfortable, but it's an important piece of how the American Republic has fought off corruption and made progress in many areas where other free nations have not. The American founders had the foresight to set their team up this way. I dare say this is how we ought to think about setting up any good team. Continual progress depends on leaders making it safe for provocateurs to make waves, for whistleblowers to raise their hands, and for dissenters to speak up when needed. Provocation prods an inert group into the zone. It helps us to stretch the rubber band. This means that, contrary to our instinct, the collaborator who provokes or contradicts us is our ally. As Dr. Namath puts it, one must learn not only to respect and tolerate dissent, but to welcome it. There are a few ways to do this. We can cast team members who will push us to think or work harder than we would otherwise, like Gillot did to Picasso or Coach Tikhonov did to the Russian Five. We can also invite outsiders with extreme perspectives to show us things we won't be able to unsee afterward, like Brian Miller did with the G Corp folks. And we can bring dissenters into our fold with the explicit instruction to tell us what's up, like the U.S. founders set up with the free press. Once we start thinking of provocation as helpful, it changes the way we deal with it. In 2016, the Pentagon made a good example of itself in this regard. Though the Pentagon boasts to have the best computer security in the world, it did something many organizations would never dream of. It invited a group of hackers to try to poke holes in its systems. The hackers, recruited by the company HackerOne, found the first security hole in 13 minutes. They found 138 vulnerabilities in all. It proved to the skeptics who believed hackers are dangerous, childish, and intentional lawbreakers, said Department of Defense agent Lisa Wiswell, that instead, hackers can be extremely helpful. By inviting provocateurs in, the Pentagon was able to build a better computer system. And the project led the U.S. Army to hire HackerOne hackers to do the same. "Take your best shot," Secretary of the Army Eric Fanning told them when the project started. Legendary civil rights leader Bayard Rustin, the man behind the 1963 March on Washington, once declared, "We need, in every community, a group of angelic troublemakers." He was right. We need the dissenters, the whistleblowers, the critics, and the extreme perspectives to help us get out of inertia and into the zone. And we need leaders who make it safe for them to do it. This is how we make progress when we're stuck. But how far does this idea go? What about people who are mentally ill? Can teams benefit from including people who aren't just pretending to be insane, or people whose ideas are actually crazy? It turned out that I was about to see for myself. Chapter 5. The Black Square. Part 1. Mark Tigan, civil servant of the village of Winooski, Vermont, was 32 years old when the President of the United States called to shut him down. This was 1979. Tigan was a bit of a wunderkind in the field of small-town city planning. Having graduated as one of the nation's first environmental studies majors at San Jose State, he developed a reputation for his enthusiasm for community projects. He'd even been on national television, in a Walter Cronkite report showing him burying automobiles to protest carbon emissions. Now he'd been put in charge of Winooski's staff of city planners to try to boost its struggling economy. With a population of 7,000, Winooski was a blip on the map. The town was nestled in the shadow of its across-the-river neighbor, Burlington, which, though beautiful and known for its recently launched ice cream brand, Ben & Jerry's, wasn't very big either. Burlington was the smallest city in any U.S. state that was also that state's biggest city. Anyway, nobody knew that Winooski existed until after the night Tigan and his staff got drunk. Winooski was cold. Temperatures regularly reached 20 below. Its downtown area had just a couple of bars and a restaurant called Winooski Restaurant. These sat next to a handful of abandoned mills and factories from New England's proud, lost industrial days. The world outside was facing an industrial crisis of its own. Iran was in the middle of a revolution, with its Shah having fled and massive protests and strikes slashing its oil refinery production. Global oil prices had doubled in less than a year. American gas stations had long lines. And the cost to heat Winooski had risen to $4 million a year, $14.2 million in 2018 dollars. By one calculation, heat for a family of three would cost more than $500 a month in 2018 money. Burlington had just put in a request for government funds to build a hydroelectric plant along the river to help reduce its own heating bill. This plan, however, would leave Winooski's creek bed dry. "Basically ruin our downtown," Tigan told me. With already high unemployment and declining commerce, Winooski might be done for. It was amid this turmoil that Tigan took his staff out for a drink and a chat. How could the city planning office pitch in to help their struggling town? One bottle of wine turned into two. Someone complained about the temperature. Someone else mentioned wishing they could put a lid on Winooski to keep the heat in. And that's when Tigan came up with the bad idea of a lifetime. What if we built a dome over the city? Everyone was tipsy by then. They all thought it was a good plan. A week later, Tigan left for Washington, D.C. on business. On the way, he stayed the night in Baltimore. There he told his dome idea to a buddy who worked as a liaison between Congress and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. "You know," his friend said, "the Assistant Secretary, Bob Embry, loves domes." Dome houses had become briefly popular during the 60s and 70s for their energy efficiency and structural integrity. Though they were funny looking, it was easier to heat a dome than a rectangular home, and hard for an earthquake to knock one down. By this time, however, dome fever had faded alongside tie-dye and pet rocks, except among a few diehards. Embry was apparently one of them. As fate would have it, Tigan's friend was supposed to carpool with Embry and two other HUD people to Washington the next day. "I'll call and cancel," he said. "You take my spot." During the carpool, Tigan pitched Assistant Secretary Embry his idea to save oil costs by putting Winooski under a big, clear dome. They could make it with airlocks for cars to enter, like a space station, and lower heating expenses like crazy. The frigid town could grow tomatoes all year round. Embry was the exact right person to say this to. He turned around from the front seat. "If you propose that, I'll fund it," he declared, according to Tigan. "I have discretionary funding." Tigan delivered the news to his flabbergasted staff. They eagerly put together a report and proposal. Winooski's mayor asked, "Are you nuts?" But when Tigan explained that this could mean millions in HUD funding, the city council signed on. The dome story blew up. The day after the Burlington newspaper wrote about that council meeting, three television trucks showed up to Winooski City Hall. National newspapers followed. Time magazine called for an interview. The Vermonters had few answers for the inevitable questions. They made up specifics on the fly. "How high would it be?" 250 feet. "What about automobile exhaust?" "We'll have electric cars or monorails inside." Bags of mail started arriving from dome weirdos. An international dome symposium was scheduled in Winooski, where the famous crackpot inventor R. Buckminster Fuller would give a keynote. Nobody had built a dome this big before. Nobody knew what it would be made out of. Would it have giant support struts? Would the town be pressurized like a balloon to hold it up? What if the dome deflated and fell on everyone? How is the city going to justify annexing the land surrounding the town that would be needed for the dome walls? It soon became clear that building and maintaining a dome large enough to fit Winooski, engineered to keep the heat in and not kill everyone, would probably cost a lot more than the heating bill savings it would generate. Plus it would, you know, ruin the view. National newspapers wrote about what a bad idea the dome was. David Letterman mocked it on his show. There was even a song made about it, Dome Over Winooski, making fun of the plan. Dome Over Winooski, not far from the lake. Transparent and lasting, still real and not fake. Dome Over Winooski, so fair and so true. Has anyone asked you, what's cooking with you? The research money might give one guy a job, said Hank Tetrault, co-owner of Winooski Restaurant, to the Christian Science Monitor. Maybe he'll eat here. The Winooski Dome soon became one of the top news stories in Saudi Arabia. Some in the Middle East started to panic about how America was putting cities under domes in order to stick it to the oil industry. That's around the time that HUD Assistant Secretary Embry's phone rang. What the hell are you doing? It was President Carter. He was running a tough election campaign against Ronald Reagan. International ridicule about the federal government paying millions to cover towns in Vermont with domes was not helping. The conversation, according to Tigan, ended with a presidential order. You've got to pull this. Part 2. We've been talking about the power of cognitive diversity for half a book now. In the last chapter, we discuss how provocation, dissenting viewpoints, and angelic troublemakers are often what we need to get a team thinking critically again. But the Winooski Dome story reminds us of an important reality. Some different ideas, frankly, are quite bad. The more perspectives we collectively possess, the better our chances of making a breakthrough together, points out our friend Dr. Page from earlier. But, he adds, just because someone brings a different perspective doesn't mean that it will lead to a better solution. Any perspective, even one that might seem crazy, has the potential to be useful under the right circumstances. But that doesn't mean that it will be. So the question we're going to explore in this chapter is, how can a team or its leaders discern when it should seriously consider a different way of thinking and when it's a waste of time? After all, a city covered in a geodesic dome was a good idea somewhere. That place just happened to be Mars. The perspective of a young activist who'd had a few drinks was unfortunately not the one that could help cold old Winooski with its heat trouble and battle over its river. 32-year-old eco-warrior Mark Tigan's cognitive diversity was just a little too far out to be of any use. Or was it? Part 3. After tromping through Moscow's streets for a bit more than an hour, I'd finally gotten out of the dreary March drizzle and into the massive Tretyakov Gallery, one of the biggest art museums in the world. I was standing in one of its vaulted rooms, looking at another dumb idea. This one was possibly even more expensive than Mark Tigan's dome, though it was much smaller. As a member of the creative industry, I believed in the power of art to convey meaning and ideas. And I could appreciate that some things we create are simply about beauty for beauty's sake. But even I had to admit that some art was hard to find something good to say about. Case in point, the 79.5 centimeter square painting that I had just traversed Moscow to see. My problem with this particular painting was that it somehow managed to be one of art critics' favorites, while at the same time regular people seemed to think it was ridiculous. Even my friends with fine art degrees in New York could find little to say about it other than it was famous and old. On the other hand, scholars like Philip Shaw of the Tate Modern said things like this. The experience of viewing the painting involves a feeling of pain, brought about by the breakdown of representation, followed by a powerful sense of relief, even elation, at the thought that the formless or massive can nevertheless be grasped as a mode of reason. New Yorker writer Peter Sheldahl called the painter's touch ineffable sweetness. He said, without irony, that the art was made with a shudder of the sublime. Meanwhile, people on the internet said things like, I could have done that in kindergarten. The hype around this painting confused me so thoroughly that I'd gone through the hoops of getting a Russian visa to check it out. In the interest of open-mindedness, I decided that perhaps seeing the painting in person would help me understand. And so, I braved winter, customs, and possible future invitations to join President Donald Trump's cabinet, this joke will surely expire at some point, to investigate. The Tretyakov Gallery has several buildings and thousands of paintings. There are meticulous landscapes and still life so realistic that I sometimes mistook them for photographs. Oil paintings of every boat, animal, and historical figure ever produced by Russia. A family of bears playing in the woods, knights on horses, dead knights after battles, and 100 gorgeous gold foil Renaissance-era Jesuses. There's even a portrait of a Russian John Goodman with a white corsage hanging next to a Russian Zach Galifianakis in a vest lounging on a red and white striped beanbag. Somewhere in Building 4, I turned a corner, and there it was, in the center of a cavernous room. I sat in front of it for an hour. While soaking it in, I noticed something. Most of the museum goers who came in ignored the painting. An elderly couple holding hands hesitated in front of it, then walked on. Two young lovers took photos of each other in front of every other painting in the room, but decided not to with this one. A portly gentleman beelined past it toward a couple of paintings of young women. Clearly the visitors that day experienced neither shudder nor sweetness from Russia's most infamous painting. Perhaps that's because the painting is just a big black square. That's it. Seriously. A black square. Nothing else. Just, you know, black paint painted in a square. It's not even that big, to be honest. It's like one of those old televisions where the screen is 15 inches and the wooden box around it is 26. I took a video on my phone as a dark-haired teenager in a turquoise top looked at the painting's title plaque, which said, wait for it, black square. She made a face that said, what? And moved on to some more exciting paintings, which was all of them. Her reaction was a much simpler way of putting another part of Mr. Shaw's outrageous review. Quote, the failure of the black square to represent this transcendent realm serves negatively to exhibit the higher faculty of reason, a faculty that exists independent of nature. In other words, the point of the black square is, literally, nothing. On the way to Moscow, I'd picked up a book about the Black Square at London's Royal Academy of Arts, with the appropriately snobby subtitle, The Climax of Disclosure, in the hopes of finding some sort of explanation for this painting of nothing. That's when I decided that its creator, Kazimir Malevich, was out of his mind. He was born in Ukraine in 1878 to poor parents, and made his way to Moscow to seek his fortune as an artist. After dabbling in Impressionism, he started painting faceless people and getting bizarrely spiritual about it. Quote, what we call reality is infinity without weight, measure, time, or space, absolute or relative, never traced to become a form, he wrote around 1920. It can be neither represented nor comprehended. The stuff he said got more bizarre and detailed over the years. Here's another example. Stimulus is a cosmic flame that lives in what is non-objective. Only in the skull of thought does it become cool in real concepts of its immeasurableness. And thought, as a certain degree in the action of stimulus, white hot in its flame, moves deeper and deeper into the infinite, creating its path worlds of the universe. Reality isn't real. Cosmic flames stimulate the universe. Got it. Malevich eventually tried to start a spiritual art movement called suprematism. The idea was to find the zero point of painting, the very edge of the artistic spectrum, beyond which nothing else existed. The black square was his masterwork. It was, he claimed, the point where art ended. Anyone who continued beyond would fall off a cliff, like those old maps when the world was still flat. There was no art that said nothing better than the black square. New Yorker writer Tatiana Tolstaya called this, quote, one of the most frightening events in art in all of its history of existence. It wasn't frightening, though. It was quadrilateral. If the purpose of art was to be as beautiful as possible, I had just found a very low point on the mountain range. If the purpose of art was to communicate ideas, the black square is one of the most exotic perspectives I can think of. It was off the range. Imagine our mountain diagram again. This time, the mountains represent works of art. There are tall peaks and shorter peaks. We have the Sistine Chapel, the Statue of David, Norman Rockwell stuff. That one's a little lower down than David. And then way off the map, to the left in the middle of nowhere, on no mountain peak, just the ground, is a painting of a black square. Black Square is saying to no one in particular, reality can neither be comprehended nor destroyed. Of course, some art serves as more provocation than anything. It encourages us to do important things.